This is an oral history interview with Carl Storm on the 22nd of August, 2002, in Kingston, Rhode Island. Arthur Demerich and Arnold Thackeray are asking the questions. Carl, why don't we start with a bit of your personal biography, perhaps parents, family, background, where you grew up.
Okay. Well, I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. Both my parents were raised on farms in rural areas, my father on a farm in rural Virginia, and my mother on a farm west of Baltimore. My father moved to Baltimore while he was in high school, graduated from Baltimore City College, which was a high school in Baltimore, went to work for a bank, got a law degree at night school while working for the bank, and eventually founded and ran the trust department for the Union Trust Company in Maryland. So he was from, a very modest background, but he was successful in the Baltimore banking industry. My brother and myself were the first two in the family to go to university education, and we both had our undergraduate education at Johns Hopkins. And I stayed on and did my master's and PhD degrees as well. The family was quite enthusiastic about our getting a higher education. Mm-hmm. But after my staying on for a PhD, then 3 years of postdoc, they eventually became quite concerned as to whether there ever would be a real end to this. After Hopkins, I went to Stanford postdoc for a year with Henry Talvey, and then went to the NIH and spent a couple of years as a staff fellow in the Laboratory of Neurochemistry at the NIH.
Right.
And the idea was to go into the general area of the function of metal ions in biological systems. And inorganic biochemistry was kind of in the process of being invented during that period of time. People like Bert Bally at Harvard and Harry Gray was just going into it at about that same time.
Mm-hmm.
After a couple of years at the NIH, then I moved over to Howard University in Washington, D.C. in the chemistry department. Stayed there for 17 years with sabbaticals and side trips to Oxford, University of Trondheim in Norway, and Los Alamos.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1985, I moved to Los Alamos on their technical staff.
Perhaps we could go back a little bit. When did you first develop an interest in chemistry? Was this as an undergrad?
Actually, when I was in sixth grade of elementary school, I decided I wanted to be a chemist, and I never really wavered from that, and my ambition was always to be a research chemist for DuPont, so I never quite realized that direct a connection.
Was that a chemistry set? Was it DuPont radio program?
Well, I certainly had a chemistry set. I had the classic Gilbert, was it? And it upset my family no end with the smells and the and the things that I used to make in the basement of that. I did a book report when I was in the sixth grade on a, it was kind of a fantasy thing, a trip to the sun. And it was, you know, imagining how you, and it was very successful. And my sixth grade elementary school teacher then had me go around the whole damn school giving this book report to this verbal book report to all these different classes. And I guess that was quite impressive. Then in the eighth grade I had a very good general science teacher, and that was very encouraging. And then in high school I had a very good chemistry teacher. He was actually a PhD chemist. And he was stuck in Baltimore for a couple of years because of some family situation. And he was also very encouraging. I think that all reinforced the idea. It was the family opinion that you really had to do something practical. So So when I went to Hopkins, it was as a mechanical engineering major. And I stayed there a year and a half, and then I spent 3 years in the regular Army. When I got out of the service and up here at Fort Devens, Massachusetts, I went to work for Foster Grant in Leominster and worked in their pilot plant and research lab for about 8 or 9 months, and then went back to Hopkins. And by that time, I had decided that, you know, whether chemistry was practical or not, that was certainly what I was interested in. And then during the additional 3 years to complete my undergraduate school, I became convinced going to graduate school was a good idea. So I just stayed there and did my graduate education as well. So it's a bit of an evolutionary thing.
Yes. Was there a problem with financing this?
Not really. That was a time when the financing by the government was just really beginning to come on stream. And when I first went to Hopkins, I'm pretty certain the semester's tuition was $150. And although that was more money than it is now, it really was not, you know, it's nothing like $35,000. I was married after I got out of the service. My wife was a nurse. So, you know, between what I could do working part-time, I used to work as a mechanic some, and my parents were helpful, and what she earned as a nurse, undergraduate school was all right. And then at that time, you could get support from the NIH by writing a research proposal. And it's very much like an R01 grant is today for the NIH. So I wrote a research proposal on the coordination chemistry of metalloporphyrins, and it was funded for 3 years.
This was funding your graduate study?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I wrote another one to postdoc at Stanford, and that was funded, and we had $2,700 for a year.
For the one that funded your graduate study,
right?
Who were you working with? What inspired you? I mean, did you simply finish undergrad and say, I'm going to write a research proposal?
Well, I was working with Alsip Corwin on metalloporphyrins. I had done undergraduate research. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I would give a very strong endorsement to about my education at Hopkins was... if you got A's in your lecture and laboratory freshman chemistry, then second semester you didn't have to take the lab, you could do research with a faculty member. And the same thing for organic chemistry. So I was doing research with graduate students and postdocs the second semester of my freshman year. I was a little more mature than many because I had been in the service for 3 years. But to me, it was a very excellent experience. So by the time I graduated, I had had 3 years of practical research experience with several different people in the chemistry department.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you've tarried just long enough along the way to really catch the post-Sputnik time.
Exactly, exactly. And... I still kind of like that idea of a graduate student going to a place like the NIH on their own, because, you know, then I was working for this person. I had my own money.
Right.
And I was clearly not part of some big machine that was, you know, you're going to put one more functional group on this side of the molecule as your contribution. Right.
So there's a whole period there in which you're becoming a new R. And a classic academic research chemist, how it went.
Yeah. And, you know, when I look back on those times, you know, you used to make your own equipment. You know, I learned how to blow glass. I used to make my own vacuum systems. And, you know, you did things with your hands. I'm not sure that's true anymore in research labs.
Mm-hmm. What made you kind of think of moving away from Howard and so on? How did that That work, that looks like a significant career shift going to Los Alamos. Is that what it was?
Well, it was pretty dramatic career shift, if you will. I went to Howard in 1968, mm-hmm. and it certainly had a heavy element of the 1960s idealism in it. In fact, Will Lepkowski did a CNE News article on myself and several other people about that time. And the idea of combining a research career with teaching, and particularly teaching in a school that had a heavy minority enrollment, you know, I found very exciting. And Howard was just coming off of the 1955 court decisions, you know, requiring integrations of schools and whatnot. And it had actually quite a good chemistry department. It was probably easily as good as any other one in the Washington area, University of Maryland, Georgetown, GW. And I had this vision of being able to run a good research group and mm-hmm. teach and do socially useful things all at once. It turned out to be a hell of a lot of work, because the university really was not designed to support research. Mm. So you had to go out and raise 100% of money that you spent. You know, the idea of having a startup package, bizarre. Startup package maybe meant you got new blinds in your office or something like that. And the attitude of the research community at large was not necessarily hospitable. Many people in the larger research community are very protective of their turf, and they don't particularly want to see new units established that are going to be competing for the same money. Mm-hmm. And I sent an application into the National Science Foundation earlier on for an NMR spectrometer, and it came back with the referee's reports that the research proposal was excellent, the work was very good, but Howard University has no business owning a sophisticated piece of equipment like this. You know, it'll last for a year and then it'll be pushed over in a corner, and you know, because they can't afford to maintain it. And it's, you know, it was true in a sense that, you know, this was not a university that had, you know, a lot of resources, that if I got it, then I would be obligated to continue to raise money for it. But I think a lot of that was driven just by not wanting to expand the... another consistent response would be that when I approached mainline research sources, they would come back and say, well, this person is probably the best scientist on the Howard faculty, and all of these organizations have money to support research at minority schools. If they're not spending on anybody, they should probably give it to him. You go then to, say, the NIH MARC program or MBRS and whatnot, they all come with language that says, the purpose of this money is to transition research scientists at minority schools into mainline funding. So since you obviously have already been successful in that, you know, why don't you go for an R01 grant at the NIH, you know, and I would lay the two reviews down next to each other. Then in the early 80s, when Reagan got elected, and along with Mr. Stockman and other people, they just went through the U.S. budget and, you know, just hacked huge amounts of money out. And I just could not see the possibility of continuing to finance. I had about 15 people that I worked with at Howard in the Washington area, $250,000 to $300,000 a year in research money that I was raising all outside of the school. And I just could not see that continuing. Los Alamos offered me a job that roughly doubled my compensation. And so I moved from inorganic biochemistry to conventional high explosives at Los Alamos.
How did you make that? Where did that contact come from?
Well, I did a sabbatical out there in 81, 82 with the Stable Isotope Research Resource, which was an NIH DOE funded project to use carbon 13 and other stable isotopes, nitrogen 15, in biological research, principally by way of NMR. So I was there for a year with that. I always did a lot of heterocyclic chemistry, and because of other things in our research group, I knew how to put nitro groups on heterocyclic compounds. So I began consulting with the explosives people about their synthetic projects, and they needed a physical organic chemist, NMR spectroscopist, to work in that. So they made me an offer I could hardly refuse.
You were getting interesting angles of vision on the research community.
Yes.
In this, at Los Alamos, as a program manager, well, you're chief scientist. How does this work? Your change of titles and roles at Los Alamos.
Well, I got out to Los Alamos, and that is an extraordinarily isolated place. And there are people that have literally been there since the Manhattan Project. And they found out, I guess largely because of my years of teaching and whatnot, that they could give me a set of view graphs I had never seen before on any one of a wide variety of topics. And 20 minutes later, I could make a presentation to a visiting group from DOE Washington or something and sound almost like I knew what I was talking about. So that was the end of my research career at Los Alamos. And you almost don't have the option of refusing, you know, those types of offers. In a big organization like that, if you want to prosper at all, you have to be a team player, and you have to do what that organization values. And so I moved into program management. I was shortly spending a week a month in Washington in places like Forest Hall, a building in Germantown, and attempting to explain and interpret to people in the DOE what basic research was and why investing money and looking at how high explosives function were going to lead to safety issues and performance issues that were of fundamental interest to the nuclear weapons program and to the Department of Defense and private industry as well.
Was there quite a cadre of chemists in Los Alamos? I mean, I think physics.
Well, actually, engineers are the largest single professional group by far. Then physicists are quite a large group. Chemists are then behind them in terms of number, and spread across all the way from nuclear chemistry to synthetic organic chemistry to biochemistry to structural chemistry, and so it's a significant.
So what sort of number of chemists would there be?
There are about 12,000 people that work at the lab. I think about 2,500 or so of those probably are professional people, so there might be 200 PhD-level chemists.
So this really is different from Howard.
Oh my word, yes. And when I got out there, they had an old JEOL 90 megahertz machine that just dead on its feet. I said, well, why don't you buy a new one? And, you know, people I worked with said, well, it just can't be done. You just cannot imagine the bureaucracy that you have to go through. So I went up and talked to our division office. It turned out I needed to write a one-page memo, which I wrote. And about 2 months later, the deputy division leader himself comes down to my lab and apologizes that they can't fund it this year. But if I send it back in next year, he's absolutely certain it'll be at the top of the list. They then said, well, you can't buy it because the bureaucracy's too. So I went down to the purchasing agents, which, you know, it's a huge department, sat down with one of them and said, I want to buy something. What do I have to do? She gave me this long list of things that you had to do, and if you answer all these questions, I got done talking with her. She said, you know, nobody's ever done this before. I followed her directions. I bought it. It was delivered to the lab. But the people, I mean, out there are just so isolated, you know, from, and it's a culture hangover from, you know, going back to the 40s. And they don't speak to each other. They don't deal with each other. Mm-hmm. So I was, after about 3 years as a program manager, I was dealing with about $15 million a year in pretty basic and applied chemistry and physics. You know, that was related to the weapons program, shock physics, spectroscopy, synthetic chemistry, and whatnot. And that was largely based on, again, being able to talk to people and get along with them and go around and interpret, you know, both what they were doing to the laboratory management and what the laboratory management wanted to them. And I actually fired 4 or 5 people that have been supported for years out of this money because they weren't doing anything. That created a huge plan. It had never been done before.
So you could do that within the federal system?
Well, I mean, I didn't not just stop supporting them. I didn't fire them literally from the lab, but I just stopped supporting them, you know, out of the money would come into a division, they would use it as a slush fund, redirect it to other things. And after a year or so, I got better things to do, you know, with the money, and they would actually winding up with the title of chief scientist was a bit of a quirk. The lab had set up a very sophisticated testing program to evaluate things that the Department of Defense did. And the theory was that they were going to be an honest referee. And they had, you know, superb computational facilities, and X-ray could take pictures of shape charges going through metal and everything. And they would look at everything that the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, other DOD labs did, and do the computations and make on come up with the best answer. Well, everybody hated it. You know, I mean, it just, and so after about 5 years, it got shut down. And the fellow that was running it at Los Alamos had actually brought a guy from the Army's laboratory in Aberdeen to run it. So they needed some place for him to go. So they said, Carl, we're going to give him, you know, this $15 million worth of money that you've been managing, and he will now be the program director for that, and you will go do something else. Well, my division leader wasn't happy with that, but again, you know, in an organization like that, you really can't argue about it. So he paid me chief scientist for the division, which was a much better title. And frankly, I had no responsibilities at all. So, and 2 years later, that guy's money was down to less than $5 million. Because he really was not a very good manager, and they just put it other ways.
What does a chief scientist with no responsibilities do with his time?
Well, it was a very short time after that that I took this job.
Okay.
It made it very easy.
What do you need to do to stop your 15 million shrinking to 5?
What I have needed to do?
Yeah.
Well, this was happening to the other guy.
Yeah, no, I understand, yeah. But it didn't happen on your watch. So what was the difference in...
Well, his idea of management was 100% top-down. He had projects that he wanted done, whereas my idea of management was much more like this organization functions, which is much more from a bottoms-up type of thing. And again, Los Alamos had a wealth of brilliant people. And when you sit down and talk with somebody and they say that, you know, they can outline this particular area of research that is has a very long-term implications for the nuclear weapons program, and they can do it very well, my attitude is you should support it. And I also wrote a strategic plan for energetic materials R&D, which they had never had before. And we could work off of that. And take, but the guy who picked it up had come from Aberdeen, and he had some very fixed ideas about what was good to do. And he would tell people, well, you're going to go now and work on this.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go talk to some other research manager. You know, why don't you hijack that money and bring it back over here, and then we'll continue to do this other project.
So, looking back, Carl, what did you learn at Los Alamos?
One of the things they asked me when they interviewed me for this job is, have you ever dealt with prima donnas? And I said, well, I was a program manager at Los Alamos. And they said, enough said. Well, I mean, there's certainly a difference between big science and little science, if you will. And I'm certainly firmly convinced that individual investigator-initiated research is a very important wellspring of the development of new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Once an area has been reasonably well defined and you have a good idea where you want to go, and the Manhattan Project was an excellent example of that. I mean, the physics of making a fission weapon was pretty well understood by 1940, and it was to a large extent an engineering problem. And a place like Los Alamos is fantastic for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to create new areas and new knowledge, to work through that kind of bureaucracy is not very kind to to that type of individual innovation.
Mm-hmm. So you really decided you wanted to get out of Los Alamos. That was part of what was happening.
Well, the Cold War was over, and it was really not at all clear what was going to happen to the national labs, to the whole, I knew enough about the Gordon conferences that I certainly, the idea of working for them, I found very, very attractive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's... let's come up this other strand. You first heard the word Gordon Conference when?
I think the first Gordon Conference I went to was in probably about 1972. Was on the Tetra Paroles Gordon Conference. Since I had done my graduate work on metalloporphyrins, I thought that might be a useful place to go. Turned out the meeting didn't have anything to do with anything I was particularly interested in, and I never went back, I think, to another session of it. At that time, they were principally interested in the biosynthesis of porphyrins and the organic chemistry. And there was little or nothing in heme proteins or metalloporphyrins or geochemistry of porphyrins or anything like that.
So how did you get into that conference? Just by application?
Yeah, I mean it's that's the way all the meetings work. Is to attend them, you have to apply. It's always been like
that. Why were you accepted? Put it that way.
Well, that's another, you might say, a dirty little secret about Gordon conferences. Most of our meetings are not oversubscribed, so I'd say about 2/3 of our meetings, unless there is some. Probably is one meeting every other year that a chair will tell me, you know, there's a crank out there that I don't want at this meeting, so I want to look at every name even though we're not oversubscribed. But, you know, we get 18,000-19,000 people a year that come to the Gordon conferences now, and most of them, the application acceptance process is really a pro forma thing that, you know, the people are not going to turn down somebody who wants to come. There is space. For the third that are oversubscribed, there are a few that are very heavily oversubscribed. They might get 350 applicants. Now, for that person to pick 140-150 people that be permitted to come is very demanding.
Let's just stay on that tune for a moment and say the economics of the conference work best when you're 100 plus. How many conferences is that not true of today?
Well, our range of participation will go from maybe 70 to 150. Our economic plan is actually pretty well insulated in several ways, in that all of our sites, our contractual agreements are that we pay for the people who sleep there on a per night basis, and that's it. So if we get 70 people at a meeting site, I don't incur any particular costs. My overhead, of course, isn't as favorable. But I don't incur any huge costs. Then the other thing that we do is we provide each conference with a chair's fund. And this year it's $22,000, but if a conference draws fewer than 100 people, then for the next meeting of that conference we scale it down to a percentage basis, which insulates us from taking a continuing loss on a small conference.
So the risk has been transferred both to the lodging institution and to the individual conference.
People
so
other than me.
was that true at the start of your watch?
Yeah.
Well, do you know when those changes occurred? Because they're very important.
All of Alex's arrangements were on a per night per person basis. They used to give every conference that met got the full chair's fund. And a lot of discussion in the Board of Trustees meetings when I arrived was that we're losing money on this conference, we've got to get rid of it. And my argument was that we should look at the science, not only the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And that I was quite willing to protect, you know, the economic integrity of the meeting, but I hated to take some place that was really excellent, vibrant science and say, you got to get out of here because you're 15 people short. So we came up with the scaled chairs fund, and the idea was that they would share the risk, if you will, that if they're really keen to do it and I can give them $18,000 rather than $22,000, you know, that's still not a trivial amount of money, and that if they're willing to conduct their business and, you know, hold it with that level of support from us, and it's great science, and we can work with them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go.
We have some sites that are more friendly to small groups, so we can.
Okay. And just say on the conference size, you said, you know, conferences with as many as 350, i.e., are very popular conferences. Can you enumerate what some of the sexy conferences are today?
Well, medicinal chemistry, I think, had 350 applicants this year, but that meeting has been taking place at least since 1944 on an annual basis, so it's been sexy for a long time. Angiogenesis has drawn some really big numbers. I have in our statistics, you know, I can give you a listing of all our conferences ranked by number of participants. Whether I can give it to you ranked by number of applicants, I'm not sure. But they're mostly in the biological and biotechnology area, where you will get the really large turnouts. We started one on combinatorial chemistry a couple of years ago. The first time that met, it had a pretty good, pretty large turnout.
Okay. Oh, I was going to ask back, taking you back to the first conference you attended. You said the topic wasn't what you quite expected. Did you actually leave, or did you stay the full week?
Oh, no, I stayed the whole week, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And most people stay the whole week. We have a little bit of a bell-shaped curve. We now, the meetings used to have people arrive on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and the first sessions were on Monday morning, and then they went through Friday noon. And we found that the Friday morning participation was pretty low. It would be maybe down to about 60% or fewer. So we phase shifted forward and start them now on Sunday evening, since people are there anyhow on Sunday, and they finish up Thursday evening and people leave first thing Friday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we run about 85% on Sunday evening. That will peak on Monday in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
and then tails back down, and Thursday night it'll be back down around 85% of the registered people will be sitting in the room listening to something going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of people we talk to say, you know, they went to a conference and fell in love with GRC. Did you go to later ones after that initial one, or were there?
No, I've gone to probably one a year since about 1972, either every year or every other year. I've been to Metals and Biology every time it met, probably between 1974 and 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And Organic Geochemistry and a variety of other topics. I gave up going to ACS meetings about that time.
Okay.
I don't think I've been back to one since. Which, I always found them to be the. I always found Gordon conferences to be a very, very friendly place to. My wife would never go to a Gordon conference with me, no matter where it was, and she said, why should I go there and be ignored for a week while you can sit around and talk about things I don't understand with other people?
Mm-hmm.
And we get very few guests come to Gordon conferences, maybe two or three.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just very intense and focused. And
yeah.
These were New England conferences you were going to?
New England, California. Metals and Biology regularly met in California. This is up at the old site in Santa Barbara. This is Santa Barbara.
How did you fund them at the time you were at Howard? Fund your own attendance at them?
Well, this is something that I always thoroughly enjoyed about the Gordon conferences, is that they were always something that I could pay for myself. Okay. You know, and many times I went to my, you know, if I had spent all my money on my students and things like that, particularly for the New England ones, I would, I was living in Washington, D.C. then, and I would leave Silver Spring, Maryland about 5 a.m. on a Sunday in my car and drive up to New Hampshire and get there about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, it was, again, it was sort of like $150 semester tuition at Hopkins. I could always afford $150, $200, whatever the registration fee was there. I certainly was not taking bread out of my children's mouth. And I suspect I usually paid for it out of research grants, but if I didn't, that was the cost was not an obstacle to me personally. And I doubt, again, being from Howard, if any chair prior to the one that I founded ever paid my way.
Why'd you say being from Howard?
Well, it's not part of the...
You weren't sexy enough to be.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
So it's the mid-70s. You've now begun attending several of them, either every year or when they're meeting on two-year cycles. Mm-hmm. When did you first chair a conference?
Well, I founded the Energetic Materials Conference in, I think it's about... Is it 88?
Is that a euphemism for explosives?
Well, it covers all of high explosives or one particular class, then propellants. There are other things like thermites. And so there are a lot of different types of metastable materials, if you will, that can go anywhere from bang to fizzle to burn. I mean, black powder is an energetic material, but it's rarely a high explosive. Mm-hmm. Ammonium nitrate is an energetic material.
Can you talk in some detail, Carl, about setting up a Gordon conference? I mean, you know, why did you want to? Who did you work with? What was it like? What are the problems? Can you live through that?
Well, when I was at Los Alamos, I worked quite closely with a fellow named Dick Miller at the Office of Naval Research. And Dick was a very good program manager at ONR. I think he's passed away now. But we used to sponsor maybe one or two meetings a year, mostly at Los Alamos, for the energetic materials community on different aspects of it. So we jointly sponsored one down at New Mexico Tech, and then had about 100 invited people, and talked across a pretty wide range of different aspects of the chemistry and physics of that was mostly high explosives, I think. And at the close of the meeting, and this is frequently an entree to a Gordon conference, there was this kind of upwelling of opinion from everybody who was there that, boy, we've had a great time. And it was a week-long meeting and everything. Why don't we see if we could make this into a Gordon conference? And myself and Tom Brill from the University of Delaware were fingered as the people to do it. So I wrote a proposal and sent it in to the Gordon conferences. It turns out at that time, there was a fellow on the Board of Trustees, I think, who was the chair of it, who was at the Office of Naval Research. He was between two different oil companies, so he was quite interested in the field. And he probably had a lot to do with its being accepted, although I didn't know him or know that at that time. I think he was probably a fortunate synergism there. And it's still meeting. It's been successful.
Do you know who that was?
It was... Now, these are the board chairs, right?
Yeah.
That would be on the next page. This guy did chair the Bob Griselli, Robert K. Griselli.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And who's in Munich now, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he had left oil company out in Ohio, was doing a stint at ONR, and then went up to Mobil. So, but I think he had a lot, probably had a lot to do with it. And then we had our first meeting at New Hampton School, and it's still meeting every other year. It's been reasonably successful.
So what about the financing of that first conference?
Well, again, the chair's fund comes from the Gordon conferences. And I'd say about half of our meetings do not have any financing beyond the chair's fund that we give them. I did get some money probably from Los Alamos and Sandia, a few thousand dollars. Most of the people that are involved in that field are from places like National Labs and the Department of Defense, so having support to come to it is not a big deal. They can usually, the labs, if they'll let them come at all, will pay for it. And actually, at the end of the week, I was walking around the halls looking for people that... you know, might need some money. And there was one guy there who was on his way. He had left a job at Princeton and was, in fact, moving to New Mexico Tech and had been too bashful to ask for any support. And when he found out I would give him $200, he became my friend for life.
Now, in the initial proposal for the conference, how did you frame it? What sorts of things go into such a proposal?
Well, this is quite specifically outlined on our website, but okay, we keep it as simple as possible. Basically, the person gives us a mock program, and they do not have to confirm this with the listed speakers or anything. You know, this is the subject title, these are the 9 sessions, and these are the people that I would ask, and this is what I would ask them to speak about in the best of all possible worlds. And so somebody who's thoroughly familiar with the field, I think, can probably do that in 2 hours. You know, and then they give us a CV. They solicit a half a dozen letters supporting it,
mm-hmm,
and give us the names of some referees. So the normal proposal, you know, depending on how carried away they get with their CV, you know, might only be 6, 8, 10 pages. And I advise them to be realistic, that if they give us a proposal that's got 8 Nobel laureates on it, our board is possibly going to question their judgment as to whether they can actually deliver it.
Right.
But also, you don't want 16 assistant professors. Probably, you know, there's a middle area of well-recognized people, 2 people from the National Academy, things like this, and you make it good, credible proposal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we send it out. And one thing that we really look for is that we don't destroy another Gordon conference by doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And often you'll get an unhappy clique from one who wants to go off and start their own because they don't feel they've been sufficiently recognized, you know, within one that is more or less addressing that field.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like I spoke earlier of the Tetra Paroles Boarding Conference. Well, we recently got a proposal from a minority woman in Nebraska to start one on cobalamines, vitamin B12. And we had just gotten a proposal from another minority woman in Texas to start one on heme proteins. And these are both going to be competing head-on-head with this Tetra Paroles Conference that's been around since the early 70s. But we're going to be in a hard position not to not to be cooperative. So,
so you would typically, that'd be peer review from neighboring conferences.
Yes.
And then there's the selection committee.
Yes. The selection and scheduling committee and the board of trustees jointly look at these and decide, you know, which ones that they want to start, and then it's up to us, largely Jerry, to decide where they can fit into our schedule.
It sounds let me caricature it a little and say it almost sounds as if headquarters is just a super efficient post box.
Well, I often refer to us in my talks to the Gordon conferences as their innkeepers. And it's basically what we're the innkeepers for the organization, and we try to keep everything organized and running smoothly. Every conference is self-governing internally. They elect the future chairs for their meeting. They administer their own money. And I try to stay out of their business. I don't micromanage their, you know, I don't review their programs. You know, I say, you've got this block of time at this place. You must stay within that block of time. You know, you cannot start at 7:30 in the morning and go to 11:30 at night, because I haven't rented the goddamn halls for those times. But what you do within those blocks of time, if it results in excellent ratings from your peers, then probably will be continued in good form. If it doesn't get good ratings from your peers, then you will probably be discontinued.
What about this territory of, you know, new areas of science, areas that quote unquote need a Gordon Conference?
Well, there are, like I worked for probably 3 years to get one started in quantum computing, because it seemed to me this was a fairly obvious area. Mm-hmm. It's not a community that we really are well known in, and it really took, I thought, a terribly long time before I found actually a woman at Berkeley and a guy at UC Santa Barbara that would give us a proposal. But that was kind of a low-key, low-level. We got one started in malaria a couple of years ago. And I called up, I sent an email to the guy who was the head of the NIH then.
Varmus?
Yeah. I sent Harold Varmus an email, as they had this meeting in Dakar, and reading about that in Science, you know, it sounded like, so I sent him an email that would a Gordon Conference in this area be useful, and to my utter and total amazement, I got a response from him about 2 hours later. So, yeah, good idea, why don't you talk to him? Gave me the name of one of his lieutenants there at the NIH. I talked to that guy who sent me to a woman up at the Harvard School of Public Health. And 3 months later, we had a Gordon Conference on malaria. But that's a small part of our business. But we're not adverse to targets of opportunity, just that we don't do aggressive top-down management.
Do some suggestions of this kind come out of the board or out of the selection and scheduling?
They can, but they would more likely go to one of their colleagues and say, why don't you send in a proposal like this? And just recently, the board, within the last year actually, has decided that they should survey the our total inventory, if you will, of meetings and look for holes. Mm. And we're in the process of doing some of that now. Mm-hmm. And the what you might call the highest level governing body at the Gordon Conferences is what we call the Council of the Gordon Conferences. So once my board gets this query put together, then we're going to send that out to this nearly 400 people that are in this group and see if they have any suggestions. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is do you sense any change in all of this compared with your predecessors and the past as known to you?
Change
In degree of thinking about and seeking to stimulate possible conferences?
I think it's qualitatively the same. Mm-hmm. And I clearly work for this 12-person board of trustees, and who makes that up, you know, is going to change. Like a current member is Jim Bristol, who's a very quite high up in the Pfizer hierarchy. And a couple of years ago, he said, "Boy, we don't have a strategic plan," you know, and this was pure corporate America. a year later, we had a strategic plan. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is a useful thing, but I suspect unless somebody like Jim is around who will take a continuing interest in it, that, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, we probably will be functioning on a less formal basis on that. And as board members express interests and concerns about different areas, then you take more interest in those, if you know.
Mm-hmm. Back to the energetic materials, you organize it, you propose it, it's accepted, you hold it. Where was it?
New Hampton School up in New Hampshire was the first one.
And did it work?
Yeah, it worked out pretty well. And we had a good participation. We had people from national labs, from the Department of Defense, universities, and a couple from industry. And it's still continuing. It's been renewed year on year. It went through a little bit of a hiatus in the mid-90s as once peace broke out and the funding for all those things dropped down. This year they had quite a good turnout, and I think there's again more interest in those subjects. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you just chair the first one, or did you stay on as
chair? You can only chair a Gordon Conference once. So.
Have you chaired other ones?
No.
No.
You know, people are welcome to chair as many different Gordon Conferences as they get elected to.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people that I'm sure have chaired at least a half a dozen. And you could chair the same one as long as there's a decent interval between them. And I might suggest that's 10 years or something like that. But the back-to-back chair of Gordon Conference... today we would not permit that in out of this office.
I love a black coffee if you're going that way.
Water? Fine. Okay.
The council is largely made up of chairs.
It's made up of all of the chairs of the active conferences, plus the board of trustees, plus the selection scheduling committee, plus five at-large elected members, plus a representative of each of the companies dating back into the 30s, plus anybody who gives us $20,000 or more in a given year is entitled to have a representative on the council.
But if the chair, if the conference chairs keep changing and changing, the council, in fact, is a...
It's a floating body. And we've attempted to address that a little bit. It doesn't have to be the chair. The particular meeting can elect a representative to council, and that person can serve multiple terms. So they can have a person for at least 4 years that represents that conference. And then these five elected members were another attempt to have some people that had a little bit of continuity. So again, you know, these things come up from time to time. They're all good ideas, but in the implementation of them, it's our failing, but we really have not track down these people that say give us $20,000 in a given year, negotiated through their bureaucracy. The money would come from the Merck Foundation. So we go back to the Merck Foundation and say, would you like to have a representative on our council? And they say something like, say what? Who? And, very sound idea in theory, but I don't think it would make much difference there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, 88, I'm sorry, please.
Go ahead.
88, you do the conference, and I presume you come back to the Energetic Materials Conference.
Yeah.
And how did you first learn that GRC was looking for a new executive director?
It was advertised in Science Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And University of California was having an early retirement program, which I was eligible for. So the combination of peace breaking out, the UC having an early retirement, and GRC advertising for a new director were all fortuitous. I was living in New Mexico. We were from the East Coast anyhow, so the idea of moving to Rhode Island sounded good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I've been at Los Alamos 10 years. I've rarely stayed more than 10 years any place in my life. So.
Mm-hmm. Walk us through the interview sequence. Who interviewed you and what sort of format, what kind of questions did they ask?
Well, they had an interview committee. It must have had about 20 people on it. And there were very fortuitous things about this, like everything in life, I guess. A fellow I worked very closely with at Los Alamos, name was John Shaner. Shaner was a physicist who was a very close friend of a guy at Cornell who was a past chair of the Gordon Conference Board of Trustees and was chair of the interview committee for, and John gave me an excellent recommendation, I think, for the job. We got along very well. Neil Ashcroft was the guy from Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a large-ish hotel room with this great long table, and about, must have been 20 people that were sitting around it, and they were had quite a few women on the committee. The conferences have had a long-standing commitment to the integration of women in science, and John Brownman was a member of the interview committee. And since I had known John for some years from Stanford, they sent him out to bring me in and introduce me to the committee. So John brought me in to the end of the table and said, you know, this is Carl Storm. And then he turned around and he picked up my tie in his hand and looked at it. He said, you know, Carl, that's the ugliest tie I've ever seen in my life. Thank you very much, John.
So now that they've put you at ease by having 20 people staring at you and insulting your clothing, what did they start asking you?
The only question that really remains very, very clear in my mind was they wanted to know what experience I had ever had dealing with prima donnas. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I had been a program manager at Los Alamos, and they said, enough said. Other things they were interested in was, I guess, my basic philosophy of management and, you know, how I would deal with an organization of this size. And it's another very fortuitous thing, if you will. Turns out one of my children is handicapped. In the course of his growing up, I have sat on some 25 different nonprofit boards, from sheltered workshops to associations for retarded citizens to, you know, in Maryland, New Mexico, different places. So I have a lot of knowledge about, you know, audits and bookkeeping and how do you manage 10 people and personnel policies and how do you hire somebody and how do you fire somebody and what do you do for the care and feeding of nonprofit boards and all of this stuff, which, you know, as a straight bench level research scientist, I never ever would have, you know, been exposed to. And I think they found that a very attractive. Kathy Taylor was, I'm pretty certain, on that committee as well. And she pointed out to me I was now going to be sitting on the other side of the table, and could I deal with that, you know, adequately? I was not going to be a board member, and did I understand working for a board as opposed to being a member of a board? But and I think they liked the idea that my research experience spanned, you know, all the way from protein chemistry to shock physics, so that I was not, you know, not going to have any image that the Gordon Conference should only be on porphyrin chemistry or something. They asked me what was I going to do about this problem of more and more of the Gordon Conference is becoming biologically oriented. I said nothing. You know, one really had very little choice. I mean, that's where the money was, that's where research was going, and, you know, you could monitor it, and you could follow it, and you could, but to make any attempt to arbitrarily, you know, say we're not going to do that, you're probably going to do a lot of damage to the organization. And they wanted to know if I was going to move the organization. That was of some interest to them.
You said nothing more than a quarter of a mile.
Well, I told them I certainly had no agenda.
Did you have thoughts and plans on how you might make some changes at GRC?
Not really. My approach to most things is to go there, find out what's actually happening, and it turned out that there were huge challenges waiting, that the organization was still in a paper and pencil mode, and the administration of it, the first
3 years I was here, I guess I went to every Gordon conference that met. So I probably went to 400 Gordon conferences in the first 3 years that I was here.
At the peak, how many are meeting simultaneously?
12 or 14, but I mean, I would go and visit.
So in 1 week, you'd bounce?
Oh, yeah. I'd drive around New Hampshire and visit every site. And, mm-hmm. and a common comment, this first 2 years, my staff would call up to a site and say that I would be by there at, you know, at 10:30 on Tuesday morning, and the chair of the conference would be sitting in a chair next to the door waiting for me with a list. And a lot of people said that the administration of the conferences was nowhere near the quality of the science reputation of the conferences, and if that wasn't fixed soon, there was going to be big trouble.
This is the mechanics of the coffee not being there, as it were, or something no. more than, or are you talking intellectually or just...
No, just getting people admitted and the finances and the internal management and lots of things. And a lot of it had to do with this transition between doing things by the U.S. mail and, you know, computers coming in and... they used to move the entire operation the 1st of June. They would get a U-Haulic truck and pack the entire office over here in Kingston, drive up to New Hampshire, set it all up at Colby Sawyer College, run the business for 3 months, and they put it all back in a truck, Xerox machines and everything, and drive back down here and then set it all up in there again. Well, there would be a two-week hiatus, you know, while all this was going on, and then there would be the boxes of mail, you know, this big, you know, hadn't even been opened yet. And, you know, people had applied, sent in their registration and their checks. They didn't know whether they wanted to come to the meeting. And so one of the first things that we did was decide that we would bite the bullet and run things year-round out of Kingston. And that was quite an adventure. I would drive to New Hampshire on Sunday morning. I had an office at Colby Sawyer College, plus I toured all of the sites and all the meetings. Thursday, I would drive back down here. Thursday night, go over to Salve Regina, then work in my office here Friday, Saturday. And then Sunday morning, drive back to New Hampshire. So I did that cycle for, you know, for 3 months during the summer. And then go to California and live out there for 2.5 months during the winter. Mm-hmm. Kept busy. Mm-hmm.
That moving the office, that has been going on since... for 40 or 50 years or something.
Since 1947.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. What else was a disjunction between your expectation and reality?
Well, I was a little surprised to find out the organization had no money. Alex had a couple of $1 million in CDs, and that there was no budget, there was no financial plan of any kind, there were no resources, and the money that they did have in those CDs really belonged to conferences, because you know, if you get private donations, if you don't spend it, then we keep them on our books and carry it over. I think there were maybe $3 million that they had in CDs, and probably $2 million of that belonged to the organization. They had about a $8 or $9 million a year operating budget at that time, so they had maybe $1 million in cash reserves, which is pretty thin for an operation.
Yes, yes. When you say there was no budget, what do you mean by that?
No budget.
You mean there was no budget?
That's pretty dramatic. The auditors, which are KPMG, made up a summary of what happened last year, and you know, you paid so much for rooms and you paid so much for meals, and it was about 8 items, you know, which were your major cost expenditures. So we now have probably a 2-page spreadsheet with maybe 100 lines on it, which, you know, break down what our anticipated expenses are. A lot of subcategories. So, I mean, it was pretty hard to tell what was going to happen next year. And the assurance I got from the staff was it worked fine last year. It probably will work next year.
When you first came on, to what extent did Alex Cruikshank kind of have a transition period? Or was it literally you arrived and here are the keys to the door?
Yeah, I mean, Alex shook my hand, wished me the best of luck. And he's the ultimate gentleman, and he wouldn't want the scene to interfere with my... And he's always been very responsive any time I've ever asked him any questions.
I mean, that first year, did you need to call him on the phone once a week and say...
No, not really. I mean, the people that worked here, you know, knew what Darlene was here then, and Suzanne, who was our financial person, were both here, and they pretty much knew everything was going on.
The permanent staff, as you arrived, by function, consisted of how many people with what roles?
Well, it's pretty much the same as it is now. We had about 12 or 13 people, and we have three people that we call conference coordinators, and these interface with the conference chairs and take care of the applications and the registrations and interactions between the chair and the site and getting their program in and all of these things. And then we have, I guess, 5 people that work in our financial office. And they do all the grant submissions and administer the money on behalf of the chairs and cut the checks for all the travel refunds and interact with our auditors and do all of our credit card charges and, you know, all of this stuff. And then Darlene is our office and operations manager. We have 2 guys that work in our AD and our IT business, plus 2 consultants. And then Jerry does all of the new conference work and the scheduling and a lot of the interactions with the selection scheduling committee board and getting that huge package of stuff organized so that they can look at it in one day.
Can you talk, Carl, about the governance structure and how it, what it is and how it works?
Actually, on the in the selection and scheduling committee, you know, in the past they divided them into 3 of them: one for biology, one for chemistry, one for physics. Is that still the case? How does that?
Well, it's certainly in name, and that has become more and more demanding to do that in any meaningful way. And what we did a couple of years ago was we split the board and the selection and scheduling committee into 3 committees. And each of those committees now has people from biology, chemistry, and physics. And each of them takes a third of conferences. So in a day, that group has to look at maybe 55 conferences. And there are people on it from all 3 disciplines, if you will. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we get an interdisciplinary view of whether or not that particular field is attractive and whether that conference is functioning. And we've gotten away from having only the biologists look at the, quote, biology conferences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When did you make that change?
Probably 4 years ago. Because they used, the whole group used to sit down and go through, you know, 100 and I guess they broke up by biology, chemistry, mm-hmm. and physics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the biology numbers kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. So
you sliced it the other way.
Yeah.
So that's one day
right.
in the year. And each of those three committees has how many people?
So they're about 7 people per committee.
And they are looking at 50 or so
right.
conferences. And what are they literally looking at?
Well, we give them a package. We assign from that committee, then we assign a group of conferences to a person as a primary reviewer, and then a group of conferences as a secondary reviewer. So every conference has 2 people. We give them a packet that has the conference program, the evaluation results from the conferees at the meeting. We have a form that they fill out. The conferee comments on the meeting, the conferee comments on the site, and any other supporting correspondence that we have had with people. So this might be, again, 10 pages.
Is there a chair's report?
Typically, that's only a fill-in-the-blank.
Mm-hmm.
But if the chair has any concerns, they're, you know, welcome to write. But they're, and we, if the conference is having any problems, we also assign a monitor to it. So there would be an independent referee monitor.
But only if there's problems?
Yeah.
What fraction of the conferences would have a monitor?
I think we had about 25 last year. I think the board had some concern about their operation.
Mm-hmm. And if you average it at all, how many conferences are scheduled for extinction or dramatic surgery as a result of?
Well, if a problem arises with a conference, the first thing the board will do is put them on probation. Then the next time they're up, if they're on probation, if they haven't clearly solved that problem, then they're eligible to be terminated, to be discontinued. I'd say typically we have 6 to 10 a year, although as Jerry pointed out at lunch last year, they only did 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I said they have to do better than that this year if they want to admit many new ones.
What sort of thing would lead me to being put on probation?
Well, this evaluation form that the conferees fill out is probably the most important thing. And that is has a section on science and a section on discussion. And if the evaluations for new science, cutting-edge science, are not good, you know, if the conferees don't say everything that was presented was unpublished and new, then they become a target. And if they have not allowed sufficient time for real discussion, not 2 questions, shut up, we got to move on to the next talk. And they complain about that very quickly. Mm-hmm. So if they get low science scores, low discussion scores. Now the problem is, even our worst conferences rarely get, say, less than a B minus. So it's, you know, kind of like the NIH grant scheduling. So what we do is take maybe the bottom 10% and say we're going to look at those. And then these are very clever people we deal with, so we get lots of arguments about why we're not doing it right. And then the numbers, if they fall below 100 people, they do look at them as to, you know, is this something that's coming up or is it something that's going down?
Is this, if you think, Carl, about what causes you most ulcers, what territory? Is this the territory that causes you most ulcers, or is it something else?
I'm sorry?
That causes you most ulcers. Is it this, or is it something else? What's most?
Is it this, meaning the evaluation?
And the, yeah, well, and killing conferences.
Oh, killing the conferences doesn't bother me at all. The things that, there's a large segment of the people that we deal with that are absolutely convinced that in any situation they encounter in their life, they can think of a better way to do it. And to a very large extent, they're right. That they're very clever people, and there are lots of ways that you can run this business. And I tell them that, you know, we've chosen this way, and if you're willing to run it this way, we can both have a very easy life. If you want to try to run it some other way, then neither one of us will have a very easy life. And we have a very straightforward franchise format, if you will. And if you're managing a McDonald's and you decide that you want to increase the amount of meat in your Big Mac by 20%, you're going to lose your franchise and you're going to have a very hard time doing it. And to run a $16 million a year business, deal with maybe 19,000 conferees and run 165 meetings with 14 people, that we're doing about $150,000 a year of business per employee. And believe me, if DuPont could do that, they would think they had died and gone to heaven.
Yes.
On the governance, what's the what is the relationship with AAAS, and how has that been changing in the time you've been here?
Well, the director of AAAS is an ex officio member of our board, mm-hmm. and Rich Nicholson was pretty active.
Okay.
We have not seen anything of Alan yet, but I see him when I go to Washington, and he is very supportive of us, and I hope he will sometime begin to turn up at our meetings. But Rich was extremely helpful to me. Because he had been running a business of this type, and plus his experience at the NSF and everything, and he was very supportive and extremely helpful. Science has been our journal of record going mm-hmm. back to 1940-something,
mm-hmm.
and I have a very good relationship with Beth Rosner, and we have worked out... we use probably about 30 pages a year mm-hmm. in science and advertise the business in different ways. A few years ago, one of the questions we asked in our evaluation is, how did you hear about the Gordon conferences? I think 22-23% of people cited science. That's probably down to about 6% now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good question. I think probably it's a measure of print journalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come to our website.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also kind of a reactive question, whether we're getting an accurate answer or not. It's a little hard to tell. But the principle method of hearing about a Gordon conference is from the chair, and the next is from a colleague. So those numbers have held up pretty high. Science has really taken the swoon, but I don't think we'll ever stop advertising in science. I know we pay them $70,000 a year for our interaction, which Beth assures me is heavily discounted. She usually tells me that over a nice lunch at a Washington restaurant. I would like to get more tightly linked with their website. I think if we began to trade more website
mm-hmm.
access or
mm-hmm.
something, it would probably do our marketing more good.
Mm-hmm.
The a huge amount hinges around the board and the caliber of the board. Is that a self-sustaining, benign process?
Well, it's self-sustaining. The board has a nominating committee. The basic requirement to serve on the board is to have chaired a Gordon conference. either chaired it or had served on the council. So, but most people on the council are there because they've chaired a Gordon Conference. So it's a little, a little bit cyclic. But you can be on the council without having chaired a Gordon Conference. And then the election is done by the council. And the board is, at least in my experience, has been very conscientious about looking for people who were both good scientists and conscientious administrators, if you will, conscientious about maintaining the health of the organization. As a result of the election that we just completed, we will have a majority of female board members come to her. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, we may be the first major scientific organization to be in fact run by women. They may fire me as the first step.
And the board itself meets twice a year?
Twice a year.
For how long?
Well, the board meetings themselves are one day, and then in the fall, that's coupled with a one-day S&S meeting, and in the spring, it's coupled with a finance committee meeting, which is about a half a day. Mm-hmm. And this is a pretty dramatic change. When I came, I think the board meetings were 3 days long. And
doing a lot.
That's what some of them said, actually. They got no information about the board meeting prior to showing up. And they walked in and they would have a stack of paper about this high, and then they would start at the top and start going through it. And they would argue about things, and then they would want to go back and change their mind, and can we vote on this? And they would, and it was just went on and on. So our board meetings now take about 6 hours, and they're well informed during the year, and they have a lot of information before the meeting. And after his second meeting, after I was director, at the end of the meeting, John Brownman got up and he said, "Well," he says, "you guys can all pack your bags and go home. I figure about 3 more years and Carl won't need you anymore." So John was always supportive.
What in that 6 hours twice a year, what is it that the board is, what are the key things that it does?
We have several committees, again, that report on the results of the selection and scheduling, on our finances. I give a report that usually takes about an hour and a half on our operations. We have new business and old business, like when we'll discuss the Chemical Heritage Foundation and things. I can give you one of our board books and you can look and see what they discuss. It's probably the best way to summarize that. But it's a pretty garden variety, you know, what is the business of the organization for the last 6 months. And I don't know whether it's good or bad, but we don't do anything on an incremental basis that's radically different. You know, we don't, by and large, have huge new ventures that we're going to, like we discussed, building this building over about 3 years. But, you know, mm-hmm. at each session, it was usually, and they had agreed to that, well, this is the next increment of information if we're going to mm-hmm. continue down that road. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, the going to California and then going abroad weren't exactly incremental.
Well, the California move was, I think, in 1962. Mm-hmm. And again, that was at the invitation of a California constituency. I think in particular the electrochemistry mafia at Caltech. And some of the people that were instrumental in that are still going to the electrochemistry conference in California. And they kind of insisted on it, you know, and they pushed the board. And the international business got started in 1991. Alex was not at all keen on that, and that was a board initiative. And Bob Priscilli and Jim Forini and Lila Diamond and some connections at Torre Bergabini at the University of Pisa, Forini knew. And they really kind of ginned it up, and I think Biology of Aging may have been the first conference that went over there, and they just kind of went and did it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two boards. One board faction thought it was going to be the death of the Gordon conferences, again, they had no financial reserves. They thought they were going to go over there and run up some huge bills, bankrupt the organization, and go out of business. And I think it was about a 6-6 split.
Yeah. Right now, that's only 10 years, and right now there are how many overseas conferences and how many locations?
This year, I think we ran about 25 in two locations, Oxford and Italy. And we must have about 60 conferences in our total inventory that are on a rotation. We don't run...
Rotation between U.S. and...
Yeah, we don't run overseas conferences per se. Virtually all of the meetings that we run are, they have to rotate on a U.S. elsewhere.
Are these typically new conferences that, or are they old conferences that say, gee, it'd be really kind of nice to...
Yeah. Well, the trick is really, if you look at a conference and it has greater than about a 35% non-U.S. enrollment, then you can begin to look for a request, because most of them are from Europe, and they say, why do we always have to travel? You know, why don't you come to Europe next time? And then the enrollment will usually flip. And it'll go to maybe 40% U.S., 60% European.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them come about that way. Many of our new conference proposals that are coming in now, though, are coming in with the specific caveat that they expect to do an international rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them ask to have their first meeting offshore, although I'm a little reluctant to do that, because their eyes are often bigger than their reality. It's nice to make sure it's going to work here before we send it off to the rest of the world.
When you first came on in 1993 and really made a push to attend basically every conference that year, did you notice a difference between the New Hampshire ones, the European ones, the California ones?
Well, I think a hallmark of the business is it should look like a Gordon conference no matter where it is. And that is one of my struggles, is to, as these people go off to different places in the world, they want to do something else. And I try to emphasize to them that, you know, we have a brand image, and I want somebody to be able to show up anywhere in the world, and the timing is going to be more or less the same, the quality of the site is going to be, you know, more or less the same, and they should feel like they're at a Gordon conference. And if that can't be achieved, then I will look for someplace else. And one of my charges was clearly to make the international business work when I was hired. That's one thing the board was quite clear about, that they wanted that set up and run as an integral part of the Gordon conferences.
What was the motivation for that? Simply science as a global enterprise?
I think that summarizes it pretty much entirely.
Right.
And that U.S. scientists should have the opportunity of having a global exposure to what's happening in their field.
Mm-hmm.
And there really is nothing else like this in the world. I mean, it's astonishing that the European Science Foundation tries, but they have a totally different business.
You are like Ray Kroc, in that sense.
Well, but I mean, you're not a National Science Foundation. You're not an NSF. You know, when you mentioned
the European Science Foundation is a private organization, though.
Oh, okay.
And their clientele, their customers, want them to run it like a Gordon conference. And I have met with very senior people in Europe who said, is there any way we can form a cabal with you that we can make these people do it?
Mm-hmm.
And they have something like the council, you know, and this had done studies, and they've issued reports that have essentially said, why can't you be like the Gordon conference? And the staff has said, because we're not going to do it.
In that regard, if you come back to the States, you mentioned Keystone. I mean, the what is the competition to the Gordon brand and model?
Well, there are certainly people in similar businesses, but the Keystone runs a different business. It's economically on a totally different scale. It's top-down managed. It's focused on skiing. Actually, Alex went to Bethesda and sat with the people at FASEB and gave them all of our operating documents and said, this is how you run conferences. And he did not want to get in the business of running biological Gordon conferences. And he said, you people are, you know, you're the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology, whatever it is. And it says, if you want to run conferences, great, you know, go rent schools in Vermont. This is how you do it. I went down to see them in 1993, and they were still giving their conferences a $7,000 a year chairs fund, which was the same amount that Alex had told them to give them in 1981. And they hadn't had the initiative to change it. And but that's still run on much more of a top-down basis. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have the same culture by a long shot. The Engineering Foundation was also a direct spin-off from this organization, but they adopted a methodology of putting the operations directly in the hands of the chair and an allied board member. So they very quickly wound up eating in Davos and Hawaii, and Peking, Beijing, you know, and their cost basis is four times what ours is. Hugely expensive operation. And they're now trying to spin their business off. I got a letter from them last year, would I take it? And so it's... you know, it's just like, you know, is McDonald's a competitor with Applebee's? Yeah. You know, well, they both serve food, but they have a different clientele. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The international conferences, the economics of those must be different from the U.S. conferences in some way.
Well, I charge $125 a person to run the business, my overhead, if you will. I charge $170 a person to fund the chairs fund. And then the balance of the conference fee is the actual residential cost at the site. Mm-hmm. And I run them all in the same way. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that if I also keep a detailed cost analysis of every site, so we can see what the actual differences of the operating costs are on site. But they kind of level out. Like in New Hampshire, we hire usually at least four full-time people to staff the conferences. At the hotels in California, because, you know, they have a desk and all this stuff, we usually will have two people on site rather than four. But I have to fly people out there from here. But so, you know, it all kind of washes out. And it's
I was going to pose a few questions in the area of industry versus academic representation, because a lot of the people we've talked to so far have, are very excited about this issue, and the point is that there's been a bit of transition over time, dating back before your time at GRC. And I guess the question is, what's the current status? What does the board think about it? Yeah. Where is the organization headed?
Well, when the conferences were starting in the 30s, they were actually driven by industry. And part of the philosophy was that the major national research labs,
which were places like DuPont, GE, Westinghouse, and whatnot, and places like the National Bureau of Standards, wanted to get together with academic scientists and teach them something about the values of doing basic research and get mm-hmm. them involved, develop mm-hmm. partnerships. That's undergone a complete inversion. I find it personally disappointing that major industry doesn't seem to see the need for really long-term fundamental basic research. But if they're getting it from universities, you know, at a reasonable price, and, you know, if that's the way the market, you know, is driving things, and if we're getting a product that suits them, then, you know, why swim upstream? And I think our participation reflects that.
Mm-hmm.
And our board talks constantly about this idea of are we not being, make sure we're not being hostile to industry, that we solicit their participation. And I can give you also a ranking of all of our conferences by industrial participation, because we keep track of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it ranges from 90% industry participation to zero.
Where'd you get 90%?
Medicinal chemistry, for instance, I think probably has at least 90%. And then
zero is is what?
Well, when you get, I'd say, of 165 a year that we run, probably 50 or 60 of the conferences have more than, say, 10% industry.
Only 50? Awesome.
Yes. Yeah. And then the other 100 or so meetings would have anywhere from 10% to zero self-declared. You know, these are.
Do you tabulate other categories besides government and industry?
Academics.
I'm sorry, besides academics and industry.
Academic,
three.
Government.
And that is the.
And private foundation, I think we also ask for. We ask for four affiliations.
Was that being asked for before your time, that sort of tabulation?
These sorts of records have always been kept. We've revised those, and we just did a major revision on our evaluation form that we'll start using January 1st. And I've tried to keep continuity so that we don't completely lose or destroy something in that process. And again, since this is all self-declared, if you ask somebody from Los Alamos where they're from, they might check industry. They don't regard themselves as necessarily a government lab, or they work for the University of California, so they might check academic.
Yeah. So is there a problem in this territory or not?
I don't think it's a real problem. You know, as long as we make sure that people in the general community are aware of the product that we have to offer. And when I give three chairs training sessions a year, and when I talk to the chairs, I tell them that when the board evaluates their conference, one thing they look for is diversity, and they mean that in every possible sense of the word. So if you have no industry people at your meeting, and it's an area in which there is an active industry, that will be a negative point. But if you, you know, if you're in many areas of the biological sciences, there just isn't any direct industrial interest, or if you're, say, in physical organic chemistry or something, you know, there's nobody left in industry that's interested in carbocations. You know?
So you run training sessions for the chairs. They come here?
No, I run one. It's usually the end of January at LAX. I run one usually the first week of March up here in Boston, and usually one in May, typically at London Heathrow.
Are they every new chair required to attend?
Well, we invite them all and we pay their way. I can't go out and kidnap them. Mm-hmm. And we will usually get, I'd say, about 140 people between three sessions, and they're usually happy, frequently told that I came because I felt I had to, and I thought this was going to be the most god-awful bureaucratic thing I ever sat through in my life. It wasn't bad.
What, other than the you must be diverse, what else do you teach them, tell them?
Well, we have a booklet that's entitled Advice to Chairs, which I would be happy to give you. And we have copies of the biographies from all of that. And basically, we go through the governance of the organization, you know, how it's maintained and governed. We go through the business operation. We go through the structure of how the meeting runs during the week, and we go through the division of responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And I'm the innkeeper, you're the scientist. I don't screw around with your science, and I appreciate it if you don't screw around with my bed and breakfast. And, you know, and if we can do it that way, it's really easy. Mm-hmm. If you want to take on the responsibility of, you know, running the business side of it, and, you know, it gets to be more and more difficult.
If you have 170 conferences going this year, will someone from the staff here be at every conference or not?
Well, I have, get around this issue of going to 150 meetings a year, we've attempted, I had a fellow in New Hampshire who had been a site manager for a number of years, who was pretty good. He's a faculty member at Holderness School. Well, he now tours New Hampshire. He meets with every New England chair every week. Mm-hmm. And he has a set level of interview questions, and then he sends us a written report on each one of these interviews, so we get some direct feedback from the chairs. And usually either myself, Darlene, or Jerry will be in different parts of the world and at different times for functioning. Then we run focus groups, and we will pick up to 10 conferences a year, and we have a set interview. We ask the chair to get anywhere from 3 to 6 people together who have had considerable GRC experience, mm-hmm. either past chairs in that conference. And Jerry has been doing most of those the past couple of years, and she gets about a 2-hour interview, and we ask, you know, questions like, how do you feel you're treated by the GRC organization? Where do you see GRC brand relative to the rest of the world? Who do you think our competitors are? What do we do worse? What do we do best? If you'd like a few of those, mm-hmm. if you'd like a lot of them, you're welcome to. They're pretty much the same. Doesn't make any difference whether we're interviewing a physics conference or a biotechnology conference.
Is that something you instituted? Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk a little, you mentioned the Keenan territory, can you say where that came from, what it is?
Well, Ruben Carbonell is the director of the, do you know the Keenan family at all? Do you know
no.
the Keenan?
I know the name.
Yeah, but they're quite a wealthy group and big foundation in North Carolina. And one of their operations is this Keenan Institute for Engineering, Science, and Technology at North Carolina State University. And Ruben Carbonell is actually a Cuban emigree
who is a professor of chemical engineering at NCSU and director of that unit. His board told him to institute some science and technology meetings as part of his program. And they talked about it and decided that if they were going to do it, they would like to run meetings that were like board conferences. And the next step was, well, if we're going to run meetings like Gordon conferences, why don't we talk to the Gordon conferences? So we had some discussions, and their first proposal was to run for them to co-brand with us for specific meetings that they chose to support. And my board said, no, absolutely not. We're not going to corrupt the Gordon Conference brand. And Harry was very involved. Harry Gray was very involved. He was crazy. No, we will not do that. So we had some further discussions, and then we came up with this idea of these Gordon Keene summer schools, which they were very keen on. This is oriented towards young people, developing technology, and they are also supporting something else that we do that we call graduate research seminars, which really came out of Metals and Biology Gordon Conference, which is one of the heavily oversubscribed ones. And they don't admit any graduate students, which is a very negative idea. So I started a 2.5-day trailer for the Metals and Biology Gordon Conference that is organized by and run by graduate students. And we call this a graduate research seminar. They come in on Thursday, spend Thursday evening with the Gordon Conference, then on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday run their own meeting, and usually 12 or 15 senior people from the Metals and Biology Conference stay over and act as mentors and discussion leaders.
So typically there's how many graduate students come?
80 to 100.
From all around the country?
All over the world.
By, is it competitive, or do you in fact get 80 to 100? Applicants.
It has never been oversubscribed.
And that's just in the Metals and Biology. And
nobody else has picked it up. I really thought that this might, because there are other meetings that could benefit from it, I think. But
did you just say that only Metals and Biology wouldn't have graduate students, or is that generic?
Well, when the meetings become heavily oversubscribed, then they have the choice, if you will. You know, I've got a full professor at MIT that's applied, and I have a third year graduate student from MIT that's applied. Now, which one do I admit?
I was going to say, Alex Cruikshank had the approach that people should come here for an exchange, not as students. So really kind of discouraged grad students participation. Have you been a little more flexible and said to chairs, you know, as room is available and, you know, smart people are applying, let them in?
Well, it's, I'd say, very much the opinion of my board that a conference that does not have graduate students in it is making a mistake.
Okay.
And that it should, you know, both from a networking and a professional development point of view for the students, and from an experiential point of view of the more senior people, that they, you know, that, and again, diversity is the word that that they really beat on. And male, female, minority, majority, junior, senior, industry, academic, government lab, you know, any aspect of diversity you can think of, pretty much, and I agree with him personally. I mean, I have no argument with him at all. And I've, you know, had dinner with many graduate students and postdocs that are just beaming, you know. That time I met so-and-so, I never thought I would meet that person.
Those graduate research seminars have run how long now? How many times?
I probably started that about 95, something like that.
And these Gorman Keenan summer schools?
They're about three. We just had the second chemical physics one this summer, so that would be 3 years ago that the first one met. Probably 4 years ago we started the plan. And our response to that has been a little disappointing. I mean, I really thought more people would step up and say they might be interested.
advertise how, on the website?
And in science and different...
There still seems to be this pattern that's been there since the 1930s of kind of slow growth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any problems in that? Or is that just kind of...
Well, the board has authorized us to go to 200 meetings a year. So they will run 175 mm-hmm. next year. And so far, they've taken what I would call a watchful waiting point of view, you know, and as long as the feedback from the field, as long as our customers, you know, say that, you know, they really like what's happening, operationally, we're a hugely different business than we were 10 years ago. I mean, Alex went to every conference and he shook the hand of every chair and knew a lot of them. You know, knew a lot of these people, were close friends.
And was physically ejected by at least one.
Alex and Harry are very good friends these days. I was at that conference when that happened.
That's when you said you wanted to be a director.
But the one problem is really suitable siting, you know, and how you make that work. I could run 100 conferences a year in California and mentor, but the market demand doesn't seem to be there. We run about 35 a year there, and everybody who wants to go there is there. And that's perhaps because it's during the winter and, you know, the interference with the academic.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to have tapped out the New Hampshire school situation. I just don't know of any additional places mm-hmm. up there that are really available and suitable.
What, is there any reason you shouldn't go to small colleges in the South, the Midwest, or this, or that?
Well, say Jerry and I were down in Raleigh last week and visited North Carolina State mm-hmm. University, which is not exactly a small college. Several years ago, Alan Calley and myself visited a small college in Virginia, not far from there. And that time, the board said it's too hot in the summer. You know, they don't want to people go down there in July. They're just going to have to stay inside.
Mm-hmm.
It's hot as hell in some of those places.
Mm-hmm.
We're now in Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island.
Okay.
So, and
so New Hampshire is a euphemism.
Yeah, right. New England is too. And this year we started at Colby and Bates, and it's promising up that way. We may wind up with 30 or 40 meetings in a cluster, you know, around that part of Maine.
Mm-hmm.
The summer seemed to work pretty well up there.
Mm-hmm.
And there are mm-hmm. small colleges up mm-hmm. there that we can use.
Where are the Oxford meetings now?
Queen's College.
Okay. Well, there are about 20 other colleges available.
Yes, and my connection with Queen's was from when I did a sabbatical at Oxford in 74-75. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how we wound up there. And it was my hope was that I could turn Oxford into the New Hampshire of Europe. And I toured all over Oxford, and I didn't get a nibble from anybody else, really. But Jerry was over there this summer and got a very good response from Worcester.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had talked several years ago with Maudlin,
mm-hmm.
and I got an email from them actually just a couple of weeks ago and say, hey, you know, we don't have any summer business now, and I'm sure you guys wouldn't be interested.
Mm-hmm.
So she's going to be back there in about 2 weeks, so we may mm-hmm. have more expansion space there than I had thought.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of sensitivity in our clientele that the UK is not Europe.
We won't discuss what it is.
That's right. But there are people that want us on the mainland.
Mm, okay.
Mm-hmm. And France and Italy are most likely, and we do have a site in Switzerland that we use very often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What has stopped you, from just building your own facility? 50 weeks a year, one facility that can host three conferences at once?
I thought about that a good deal, and I think in the long term that could well be where we'll wind up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, 10 years ago we had no assets at all. Right now I have $16 million in liquid assets in the bank.
That's very healthy. Rates of appreciation.
And if the goddamn stock market hadn't dumped all over, so it would be a lot more than that. But, and I think quite possibly to have an Asilomar-type place on the West mm-hmm. Coast and a similar place on the East Coast could well mm-hmm. be. But when I came here in 93, I spent a lot of time the first year assessing how this organization was and kind of where we should be going. And then I invited all of the past chairs of the board to a one-day session out at the university. It has another campus west of I-95,
mm-hmm.
and we met out there, and they have a meeting center out there, and Fred sat in the front row with his cane with his hands on top of it, and I got done. He said, "All right, Carl," he says, "you tell me how much this is all going to cost."
Because you were outlining some of these ideas.
Yeah, some changes in operations and what we needed to do and what our opportunities for growth were. One question I asked was, we have a very well recognized brand name. Should we do any fundraising? I said, no. You don't divert your attention. Run your business. And I think the board is now at a point where they would consider doing some major fundraising with institutions. And if we were going to build, I would build a double site, not a triple site.
Mm-hmm.
And this building cost me $1.5 million. So to build two first-class lecture halls, Motel 6 type dormitories, dining facilities for a double site, I guess you're talking about $30 million construction project, maybe. And that, we could probably bite that off sooner or later. But the Centennial campus at North Carolina State might not be a bad place to build something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've got 1,000 acres right next to Research Triangle, very upscale businesses mm-hmm. going in there. Mm-hmm. Could maybe even get it financed. Some combination of Research Triangle and some other things.
Yes. That's interesting. Another allied territory is, over time, the center of gravity has kind of moved from chemistry towards biology. If you survey the world out there, say, what about the social sciences?
Well, I would rephrase your question, your statement a little bit. I think over time, the center of biology has moved to chemistry.
Okay, I won't dispute that.
And the definition of the Gordon conferences, say in the 30s, it was called the chemical research conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do now really is atomic and molecular science.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the common thread through everything, from mm-hmm. geophysics to neurochemistry. It's really, if somebody comes to us and says they want to look at the atomic and molecular basis of fill in the box, mm-hmm. then we do fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think other organizations would do well to use this type of methodology, and I would be delighted to coach them. In fact, when I was in Tokyo a couple of weeks ago, that was the theme of my visit with
JSPS, Rican, and other people, that if Japan would start an organization similar to the Gordon Research Conferences, I would be very happy to coach them and interact with them. If they then had meetings that needed international exposure and back and forth, rather than my reign, you know, a worldwide organization with 14 people. I had a very good friend for several years who was dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at American University, and she was a Shelley scholar. And I tried to encourage her to, you know, I mean, you people don't have any money, right? And she would smack me when I said things like that. I mean, I would think doing things in this economical way would be very useful. But I just could never really get any response from her.
Slightly different question. Carl, from your own experience and from what you've heard, can you talk about what I'll call flagship conferences and seminal moments? I mean, you mentioned methods in biology, and there are certain conferences that are very robust and central in certain ways to their field or what you will. There also, there is a folklore of things that came out of Gordon Research Conferences. Can you just talk to those two issues?
Well, I mean, some things like natural products, you know, goes back to the 50s when Carl Durassi and some of these other peoples, and it was really focused on cholesterol types of things, and it has remained, you know, incredibly healthy. Heterocyclic chemistry and inorganic chemistry, organometallic chemistry, organic reactions and processes, the enzymes and cofactors conference actually goes back into the 30s, and it was called vitamins. They really have had a self-sustaining constituency that was able to regularly reinvent itself and, you know, and keep the graduate students coming in. They learned about it in graduate school. They came back as they moved into, you know, new but related areas. They took the conference with them. And so we have, fortunately, a nice core group of meetings that perform very reliably and have a very dedicated constituency that goes with them. And, you know, they're up at Kimball Union or Colby Sawyer or Proctor Academy, and if you tried to move them out of there, there would be a revolution and they would lynch you. And they seem to be very happy. And they're internally self-administered, so they develop their own conventions, their own traditions, and as long as they don't turn out to be hugely contrary to the way that we run the business, then that's all right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What you mentioned in conversation before, some of this Dudley Hirschberg. Mm-hmm. And molecular beams is one example of something with a very strong, an innovation with a strong Gordon connection. Can you point to others that you've been told about?
Well, this is something that I would really like to find out through our exercise. I think this would be one of the very most important things that we could find out. And I've been told anecdotally from time to time about things, and I guess I should have dashed someplace and written them down, you know, immediately. And people put a great deal of value on
important things being announced for the first time at a Gordon conference. People choose this as their venue to tell their colleagues for the first time. I would really be more interested in things that sort of came up from the grassroots and were created from the interactions at the Gordon conferences. And like nucleic acids and proteins was a meeting before that was split up. It used to meet at New Hampton School in the 50s. And I've been told that there were regular discussions at that meeting as to what the genetic code was, and that when Marshall Nirenberg first figured it out, that's where he made his initial report of it. But he was a regular participant in that meeting, I believe, and probably a lot of that strategy for its being a triplet and everything probably, you know, could well come out of those discussions.
No, I'm asking the question because just anything that you have to, if you get it onto the tape, it will have been written
right
on. And that's obviously something that we look to find other information.
But the strategy is to how to capture that information, which your questionnaire is part of. But I think we might do better to focus only on that for one round of questions and make a very accessible place on our website and encourage people to come just to address that question.
I think we're getting to the end of our question list. Arthur, have you got other?
No, I think for what we can perhaps call an initial meeting with Carl Storm, we may want to pick this up again.
All right.
Once we're further into it on our end.
Carl, anything else you'd like to say at this moment for the record?
Well, as far as the oral history goes, I think you've probably found out more than I know about the Gordon Conferences.
Okay, well, we'll thank you.